Monday morning. Hope you had a nice weekend. Lloyd, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And this weather, man, I mean, you couldn't beat it this weekend.
It was absolutely perfect.
It was.
All weekend. It was the perfect temperature. You got a little hot there.
Oh, yeah.
But it was just sunny, beautiful. And my goodness, I mean, did it look beautiful on TV?
Oh, my God.
For the Chevrolet Detroit Grand Prix presented by Lear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not only did it look beautiful on TV, even with some of the local coverage afterwards, it was just a lot of people downtown, everybody enjoying themselves. It was just really nice.
Yeah, and Alex Blow, who's a four-time Indy Series champion, won it yesterday. He crossed the finish line first. And, you know, he led for 71 laps. It's his third street course victory of the year. And, again, you just the way that these races are different. I mean, this race is a complete 180 from what we saw last weekend in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different race. And some guys really lean into it. They like it. It's a little slower. I mean, they get real quick down the stretch.
Yeah.
But my goodness, it was it just looked absolutely stunning on television.
These street courses are really, really different, you know, and it's bumps in the road, but you know, the drivers love that. Also, you know, when you're on the street course, those manhole covers?
Oh, yeah.
They have to be welded down.
Correct.
Because they say, the cars go past and just suck it up, man.
That's the last thing you need to see a manhole cover pop up and then Graham Rahal's airborne.
Exactly.
Yeah. No. We don't need that. Kyle Kirkwood finished second and Graham Rahal finished third. It was, according to Alex Palou, tough day out there on the course,
yeah.
But he handled it really, really well. It was impressive. And we're going to talk to Michael Montri, the president of the Detroit Grand Prix.
Yes.
Coming up at 6:49. He'll be in studio with us talking about all the wonderful things that happened downtown yesterday.
A 67-year-old man in custody after crashing an SUV into the Evans Terminal at Detroit Metro on Friday morning in a startling incident that authorities say could have been really a lot worse. Investigators say the driver entered the wrong way near door 4, maneuvered through gaps in security barriers, drove up onto the sidewalk, and crashed through terminal doors before stopping just short of the TSA checkpoint. Airport police responded within seconds. No injuries were reported. Officials say the man later made bizarre statements after being detained, claiming he was at the airport to meet actor Tom Cruise and save his dad. Neighbors in Southgate told investigators they witnessed hours of erratic behavior before that crash, including the man throwing objects into neighboring yards overnight. Several residents said police were called earlier, but initially found him on his own property. Temporary, concrete barriers have now been installed at the terminal. Authorities say the investigation is ongoing. Charges have not yet been announced. So this was definitely some type of mental breakdown.
This
that
is
happened.
The second time in 4 months.
I know.
That somebody has driven a car into a terminal at Detroit Metro.
And it's like, you know, you just never would have thought that ever, you know? But, I mean.
But both of these situations sounds like there were some sort of mental health issue.
Mental health issues both times. I mean, and he was going to, you know, meet Tom Cruise and save his dad. Yeah, and he was acting strange around his neighbors. And so, yeah, this was some type of breakdown that happened. So hopefully he gets some help.
Yes, and meanwhile, the situation in Iran. So Donald Trump still has not signed this memorandum of understanding at this point. And what that leads to, he says he's in no hurry. He said this is going to take a long time. If you're going to be in a hurry, you're not going to make a good deal, is what he said this weekend. He said an agreement was preferable because it would allow the Strait of Hormuz to reopen immediately, bring gasoline prices down, and prevent additional casualties. But if Iran falls short of his terms, quote, we're going to end it in a different way, saying that they're going to end it one way or the other.
Yeah.
What that means, that's obviously military action.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's obviously heavier involvement. Again, does that mean boots on the ground? We don't know. But the diplomatic route is one that they are actively trying to investigate at this point, and they have made progress, but still no deal.
I mean, talks are still happening.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Know. Yeah. The other interesting thing here now is, according to a number of reports, the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has submitted a letter of resignation to the office of the supreme leader. The Iran International reported Sunday that the letter stated the president and his government had been excluded from major decision-making in Iran. This goes to some of those reports that we were hearing of some of the fractured, leadership structures within the regime.
Yeah.
And now he has tendered his letter of resignation, again, in a time when those conversations are ongoing.
It just, you know, it's not a good time. You know, the timing is seems a little bad for that, but there are issues over there. And, you know, I hope that we're talking to the right people over there.
Well,
you know, because it seems like they have different factions.
Sure. and I guess the other thing that was pointed out in these reports is we don't know if Mujtaba Khamenei is going to accept that resignation.
Exactly.
So maybe he keeps him in place and away we go.
A new political controversy unfolding after Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson addressed questions about her past role on the Southern Poverty Law Center's board, calling her involvement mostly ceremonial during her time, which was from 2014 to 2018. Benson said she was not aware of allegations in a federal indictment claiming the SPLC used paid informants to infiltrate white supremacist groups, and emphasized she was serving as dean of Wayne State University's law school during much of that period. She defended the organization, saying the legal case appears politically motivated and should be allowed to work through the courts. Republican critics, however, are questioning whether board members should have known more about the group's activities, with some calling for greater transparency regarding Benson's role. The discussion comes as Benson continues her campaign for governor, while broader scrutiny builds around multiple political and legal investigations involving Michigan officials and organizations.
Mm. It's becoming an issue.
Yes.
So she needed to address it. Whether that's good enough, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, it's certainly, and look, she is by far the leader in the primary.
Absolutely.
Over Chris Swanson.
Especially since Mike Duggan has dropped out.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I'm not, maybe Jason can weigh in on this. He's our resident Tigers guru. Can you explain to me what A.J. Hinch was doing taking Keider Montero out in that game yesterday?
He's had him on like a 60-70 pitch count.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's what happened there.
Okay, but he was pitching a two-hitter at the time, right?
Two-hitter, six shutout innings.
It was like two starts ago, Montero's pitching really well.
Yeah.
And he took him out.
Yeah,
really early.
I don't know if I agree. I mean, look, AJ Hinch, I love AJ Hinch.
I think
he's a great manager.
I do too.
Far be it for me to criticize AJ Hinch, but
the bullpen hasn't been as reliable as it's been in the past.
They have
not. Again, like I always say, we're not scoring any runs. So
not scoring runs.
Exactly.
Bullpen's unreliable, and you got a little juice on the mound.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes. To me, you just kind of let it ride, right?
Let it ride. Exactly.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was. It was like two starts ago, and I go, what is he doing? Ride the hot hand.
Yeah, you know? They lose 2-1 yesterday to the
worst
White Sox
record in the American League. Do you think that you would be hearing that at the beginning
Never.
Of June?
I didn't think
no,
so.
No, they're 16 games behind, or 16 games under 500 at this point. So it's just, it's such a strange vibe right now. I mean, look, they've been bitten by injuries. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, definitely.
There's no doubt.
Definitely.
But
we still got to get.
I mean, they
back,
can't
man.
Even run into one, it feels like.
Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, Chad, live and good from the Detroit News. Is secrecy fueling the consternation around data centers here in the state of Michigan? We'll talk about it. It's next on JR Morning. All right, we'll get to data centers momentarily. But, of course, as always at this time on the Monday, we catch up with Mike Lee at Crane's Detroit Business, which is brought to you by Mercantile Bank. Looking for a new business bank? Mercantile can help drive your business forward. Learn more at mercbank.com. Mike Lee, good morning. Happy Monday.
Good morning, Chris. Happy Monday to you.
Well, we were all on Mackinac Island last week, and the huge news that MSU President Kevin Guskowitz was stepping away, leaving for Clemson University. It was a shocker.
Kind of a surprise. Kevin Guskowitz was actually supposed to be on stage at Mackinac on a couple different occasions, and he was a late scratch, and we found out why on Wednesday when he told the world he's taking a new job as president of Clemson University, which really it became, you know, it was in a lot of ways the talk of the conference. And it prompted a whole lot of folks, including the governor, the chamber leaders who put on the conference, and many others, to talk about how Michigan selects the trustees for its universities. Guskowitz put out a little bit of a farewell letter in which he he pretty directly called out some members of the board for playing games and serving their own personal agendas. Of course, Michigan elects the board leaders for the University of Michigan, MSU, and Wayne State, unlike all the rest of the public universities. And saw some pretty direct calls from up to and including the governor calling for amending the Constitution to change that and have them be appointed by the governor, like the other universities, like Grand Valley, like Oakland University, which are all run that way. And you kind of don't hear as much about them as those who are elected in partisan elections. Mm. There's a resolution in the legislature pending to get support to put this before voters on the ballot. We'll see how the momentum is coming out of last week, whether there actually is impetus in Lansing to do that, something that's been talked about for a long time.
Right.
But the suddenness of this maybe has added a little bit of fuel to the fire.
Mike, you can look out the 8th floor window here of the Fisher Building and see the Gordie Howe Bridge. No cars are going back and forth. Do we know when it's going to open?
We still don't know exactly when it's going to open, but it increasingly it's getting closer. There are reports that it could be ready to open in days, but no one in the bridge authority has said it would open this spring, and spring has about 3 weeks left. So it's just kind of a waiting game to see if what needs to happen with the Trump administration yet. It's worth looking a little bit at why the bridge was built. More than $300 million in goods cross between Detroit and Windsor every day. Almost all of that goes across the four-lane Ambassador Bridge, which is almost 100 years old. The vulnerability there was shown in 2022 when protesters blocked the bridge for nearly a week, which was a billion-dollar cost for industry. Just-in-time manufacturing, the Ford CEO once noted that a shutdown could create a seat shortage on the F-150 within about an hour,
right?
Because the seat supplier sends those seats to the factory as they're needed continually. So the Gordie Howe has six lanes, connects 401 and I-75, and the auto industry especially is eagerly awaiting that new route.
I think we all are to a certain. We all want to head on over on the Gordie Howe Bridge. Mike Lee, always appreciate the time. Thank you. We'll talk again next week.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, Chad Livengood in the Detroit News with an interesting piece on data center secrecy at the heart of why maybe so many people in the state of Michigan are having trust issues when it comes to these projects. And Chad Livengood, the politics editor and columnist at the Detroit News, joins us. Chad, it's good to have you. You were talking a little bit about your piece. The conversation on the island should have been more about transparency. Is that the crux of the issue here, you think?
Yeah, I mean, there was these themed panels called WTF, What's the Fix? And I think at the heart of fixing a lot of issues in our state is WTT, where's the transparency, or even where's the trust? I mean, there is just major trust issues with the electorate has with government right now. And these data centers are just kind of the ground zero, a point of tension right now. Among voters in rural areas, exurbs, just think about where all the data center fights are at. Saline Township, Howell Township, Washington Township, places that are on the fringe outside of the suburbs of Detroit, where there's enough land to assemble 400 or 500 acres and put and build one of these gargantuan warehouses to store all this. There's these computers that use all this electricity and water. And so it really is, it comes down to like the secrecy of these things coming in. I mean, the Google project in Van Buren Township, which is now a done deal, going to happen. this takes just, you have to really suspend your disbelief to understand how much electricity is used for this thing. It's the equivalent of Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Monroe, and Washtenaw County, all residential homes in those counties to come close to this, to the how much electricity this Google facility will use in Van Buren. Then there's their one in Saline Township. So, you know, voters have a lot of questions. DTE ratepayers have a lot of questions.
Yeah.
How am I going to be protected from rate increases if this thing fails? Now, they've got a law that has not been totally tested yet, but would suggest that it will just put the bill on Google. And if Google were to pull out in 5 years into their 20-year power agreement with DTE, it would they would have to pay the bill for all the additional electricity generation that they have to pay for, and the grid upgrades and all that to essentially support this massive facility. So, I mean, these are the kinds of things that they have, because these things get shrouded in secrecy and non-disclosure agreements. The Van Buren Township officials had their lips sealed for like 9 months. Same thing happened with Microsoft and several townships out in Kent County where they were looking at and still are trying to pursue a data center with Consumers Energy. So the heart of everything is
transparency. Transparency, trust, and getting the information out there. Chad Livengood, appreciate your time as always. Thank you. We'll talk again very soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, and one of the things we heard from Garrett Rochow, the head of consumers, was, you know, it's a lot of misinformation out there wade through. More coming up on JR Morning. Well, on our way back from Mackinac last week, we threw on an episode of Jamie's podcast, the new episode.
Which was with her and her husband, Ryan.
And I loved the conversation because, well, first of all, it felt so raw and emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Because they kind of gave us a behind-the-scenes look of what that was like, this whole process.
And, you know, you don't hear a lot. I mean, when a person has cancer, you know, you hear about that person. You don't a lot of times hear about that caregiver's perspective, mm-hmm. the husband's perspective, the partner's, perspective. And this was a way for us to hear that because that's serious as well.
It's Jamie's Journey. Angels Along the Way is the podcast from Jamie Edmonds as she documents her journey through breast cancer. And in this particular piece that we're going to play, they go through what it was like in the early stages when they first got that call, when they first got that news.
Let's go back to that phone call that we got on February 10th. I talked about it on episode 1. You work from home. I've been waiting for this call. I run down the stairs. I put it on speaker. And she says those words that it's cancerous, it's positive for cancer. I remember looking at you. Your face, you look like a ghost. What were you thinking in that moment?
Fear. What's going to happen next? What do we do from here? I remember more leading up to it, right? I remember the weekend before and the time leading up to it and being really nervous about it. But not that nervous about it because you talk to your doctor and they said, do you drink a lot of caffeine? It's probably just a cyst. Lauren, former podcast guest, was telling you she'd had similar scares. Other people were telling you they'd had similar scares. So no family history. I was expecting a cyst or, you know, some type of better news than what we got. I was not expecting to hear what we heard. And when we did, it was just shock, you know, and fear to start.
I mean, I broke down in tears like immediately. And it was like, I was having an out of body experience. I couldn't believe this was my life. And I couldn't formulate words. You were able to formulate words and ask questions of the person on the other line, the nurse who was calling. How did you do that?
Reflex, right? I ask questions all the time. That's what I do for a living. And you know, once we knew when she said you had cancer, there was a lot of questions for me. You were, you know, distraught and I just went into what I do or my mode and just wanted to gather information and see what questions they could answer for us at that point. Just scared and wanting to know whatever they knew or could share at that time was really just how I reacted in that moment. Mm-hmm. But reflex, right? Like I just started asking questions.
I feel like that was your role that whole week, because the next day, I forget who it was, whether it's a PA or a medical assistant or something, they call you to give you even more information. Remember, it was on FaceTime.
Right.
My parents were here. You had more questions then.
Right.
Then the next day after that, we met the oncologist for the first time, Dr. Lutfi at Henry Ford. And again, I'm still like very emotional about what's happening to me, and you were asking the right questions, and I'm grateful to that.
Yeah. Well, another thing is, like, professionally, like, I've done medical malpractice cases. I did asbestos litigation for many years, which involves lung cancer and mesothelioma. So I've read a lot of pathology reports. I'm not in by any stretch of a cancer expert, but I know some things about cancer through, you know, professional work that I've done. And I was just, again, just asking questions that I want to know the answer to and that I thought were relevant for, you know, purposes of the upcoming treatment that you had and stuff that we'd want to know. And at that point, you were still in like a really, really like dark place and probably not ready to just start asking questions and or taking in information. So, I mean, it's just kind of what I resorted to and wanting to gather and know as much information as we could from the people that they were giving to us and that we had an opportunity to speak with in terms of doctors or social workers or nurses or whoever, you know, was talking to us about what was going on at that time.
And you know me, you know what I can handle and not, and like the prognosis, the statistics of how this cancer, you know, reacts and how people do with it. You knew I didn't need to know that information. There was a moment with the oncologist where you're kind of like, we don't need to know that part.
Well, that's because your mom started asking inappropriate questions in your presence and like wanting statistics on prognosis, on survival rate, on things that like you were not prepared to hear at that time and that you had told her you didn't want to ask or hear. And she went rogue and started asking those questions. And I just told the doctor, like, don't answer that question right now. We'll talk to you about that later because you were 1-2 days into, you know, this incredibly terrible news. And it wasn't a good time for you to hear that. And it wasn't going to change anything, right? Those statistics in many ways don't do you any good at this time. Your case is your case, right?
I am me with my biology.
Right.
Interesting perspective. I mean, you can draw some parallels
definitely
to this.
Oh yeah. It was similar to me. You know, my wife had breast cancer as well. And I remember her calling me from the doctor's office and crying, telling me, I have cancer. And I was like, hold it, what? And so I had to calm her down. And then I wanted to talk to the doctor. I started asking questions. So I understand what Ryan said. He started asking. Ryan, you know, he's a lawyer. I mean, he does depositions. He asks questions. That was the first thing came to his mind. And I mean, the caregivers, though, you have to really think about what they go through as well, you know, because it's hard for them as well. It's hard.
Yeah. It's funny. That's an aspect that I never would think about. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad she did this and I'm glad Ryan did it.
Absolutely.
Because I never would think about that, because in my mind, I'm thinking like, okay, what's the next thing we got to do for you? What's the next? But then there is a toll to that. There is a toll to that caretaker. So I'm glad they did it. It was a great, great episode.
It was.
And you should go and listen to it. Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. And anywhere you can go get your podcast, WJR on YouTube. Mm-hmm. You can catch it. You can watch
Spotify,
the video of them
everywhere.
There.
Yep.
But yeah, anywhere you get your podcast, just search Jamie Edmonds and you'll find it.
Yep.
Meanwhile, this is interesting. Speaking of, scientists say that cats and humans share many of the same cancer-causing genes, which could help lead to new treatment for both species.
That is good.
Researchers analyzed tumors from 500 domestic cats worldwide. They discovered strong genetic overlap between cancers in cats and humans. One of the things that they called was the key finding was the FBXW6 gene showed up in both. They linked to an aggressive breast cancer in humans and mammary tumors in cats, and they showed similar blood patterns, lung patterns, bone patterns, skin and GI system patterns, that they feel like this could be a really good avenue for them to travel down to try to find.
That's going to be very helpful.
Isn't that interesting? I would have never thought. But cats do share a lot of genetic DNA with humans, even more than some other animals that they use in research. So they feel like this is going to be particularly beneficial.
There's also a new pill that they're testing right now that seems like it's doing very well for people who have pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
You know, and it's
Ben
been
Sasse,
well.
The former senator, is going through that.
Is he going through that? Yes. You know, and it's not a cure, but I mean, it kind of like doubles the life expectancy of people with pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. Incredibly fascinating stuff. Thank God these doctors and scientists and researchers are out there doing this work.
Yes.
6:44 time for Ion Engineering, brought to you by CSP, rethinking composites for a lighter, sustainable future. Learn more at thecsp.com.
Hybrid powertrains have been making a comeback. Now, mega supplier ZF is betting that it won't stop with passenger cars and light trucks. The company's Traxon 2 hybrid transmission is meant for heavy-duty trucks and coaches and could even be used for medium to heavy-duty mobile cranes. The automated manual transmission features an oil-cooled permanent magnet synchronous hairpin electric motor that can continuously deliver up to 190 kilowatts, or about 254 horsepower. It includes a one-gear transmission and a dedicated transmission control unit. An independent 600 to 800 volt silicon carbide inverter is designed for flexible system setup and to ensure optimal powertrain efficiency. ZF's Intarter, a device that slows the vehicle while avoiding brake wear, is included. The company is testing the transmission in the field and eyes having it ready for 2028 release. For SAE International, I'm Chris Klontz, and that's an Eye on Engineering.
Well, the 36th Detroit Chevrolet Detroit Grand Prix presented by Lear is in the books. It was Alex Palou who went and dominated, quite frankly, almost from start to finish.
Yeah.
He takes the podium, and it was just a heck of a race, heck of a day. The city looks stunning on TV.
And my thing, too, besides the race, is just, you know, the weather. I mean, I can't remember a time when you had all 3 days.
It's pretty good.
Was just perfect. Yeah, and even the days leading up to it, gentlemen.
Yeah,
we're also
Michael Montri, the president of the Detroit Grand Prix, joins us. It's great to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us in.
Merrill Kane with us as well. Nice to see you. Are you guys?
Nice to see you guys.
Have you been able to catch any sleep at all?
I was telling Michael I got more sleep last night than I think I have in a week. And that's like 4 hours. So that was
pretty good. Oh man, you're doing good.
Yeah, all added up to a full night's sleep over the last four.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Talk about what all the work that goes into this before we get into the race, because I mean, just the visuals, the weather. I mean, the fans. It all was just perfect.
Yeah, it's a year's worth of planning. I mean, we start planning for next year on Tuesdays after the checkered flag flies, and it's just a year-round operation. So we'll have our meeting. We'll figure out what we're going to make better for next year, change, and we'll start to work on those changes the very next day. And those will all, take place over the next few months. And then it's so amazing to see it all come together almost a year later after starting planning. So it's definitely a full year of planning.
You know, and I know we won't get the full numbers for 2026 for, you know, a couple of days, but it, you know, for all accounts, it looks like it's probably done a lot better than even the year before, which was great as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at some, first of all, you see the crowd, and the crowd is phenomenal all 3 days, really. Friday was really bad.
Pre-day.
Right? Yeah, it really was. And, but then you have some anecdotal stuff, like you see stuff, and then we're starting to get a couple metrics in. Our concession sales were up. Our merchandise sales were up. So those are really the key indicators to say attendance was up for sure. Uh-huh. So we'll get those final numbers in soon.
And what I love about it, obviously the race on Sunday, but it's all the events leading up to it, all the other races that are involved. So if you are a true blue racing fan, I mean, you can't get enough of it.
Yeah, and I think the refreshing thing also, you know, beyond the fan reaction that we saw, and we had so many great comments from fans, like you said, it was packed all weekend, Michael, was the comments we got from the drivers, from the folks in Indy Next, the young up-and-coming stars, to the guys in IndyCar yesterday, and as well as the sports cars that we saw on Saturday, which was a great race, really action-packed. Everybody was really complimentary of the circuit, the changes that have been made to make it even better from a racing perspective, and there was so much action on track. So many passes, like so much competition.
173 on track
passes.
Pretty good.
That was just yesterday. And even in IMSA, it was a ton of passes. And it seems like every time you're looking up, somebody was passing somebody or somebody's getting into somebody.
Uh-huh.
Or there was a lot to keep people excited and engaged. And I think we saw that in our fans.
You know, and Detroit has become one of the most unique stops on the IndyCar calendar. What is it about this course that creates so much unpredictability and excitement?
I think it's a couple things. First of all, I think it's the shape of it, right? You have a giant straightaway down Jefferson. That's a long straightaway for any road course at all. But to have it be on a temporary street circuit where the walls are so close on each side, it's super unique. And then you get to the end of it, and they go from going 180 miles an hour in the Indy cars all the way down to about 55 when they round that corner. And there's a ton of passing and excitement that happens under braking. And you see that excitement in that corner. That's where most of our grandstands are. That's where we sell out the quickest. Mm-hmm. Yesterday was a sellout all around in every grandstand, but those sell out the quickest because that's where all the action takes place. And make no mistake, we were talking about the drivers a little bit. They love coming here because they see those fans. There's nothing the driver hates more than going to an empty venue.
Oh, of course.
When they see fans in the stands, when they see it crowded, when they're walking around, they feel like, you know, stars, like they like that, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They get that here in Detroit.
Well, and also they feed off of it, right? That's part of the reason why. Hold on, my watch is talking to me.
I'm like, somebody else. Right, right.
Radio watch feels the same. They're like, yeah.
Yeah. they feed off of the energy.
Absolutely.
Right? We see that in almost every sport.
Absolutely.
And we hear athletes talk about it all the time. If you guys are louder, we do more. And it certainly feels that way with all of the action on the track.
You know, it's cool to see. We do the autograph sessions inside the Renaissance Center, and it's always cool to see that on, like, Friday we had a packed house for IndyCar, and it was full for IMSA and Indy Next as well on Saturday. Yeah, it's just cool to see people come out and kids come out, getting a chance to meet their heroes. And you're right. I mean, I think the drivers really embrace that. It's a unique fan base here in Detroit, right? It's the Motor City, but people love their sports here, and they embrace it. And I think we've really seen that grow, especially since we've been back downtown and since 2023, how this has become an ingrained in kind of the culture in the Motor City. It's cool.
How did the drivers feel about, I mean, it was on Belle Isle for a long time. You know, how did the drivers feel about, you know, it being in the street as opposed to Belle Isle?
Well, you got to remember, there's only one happy driver at the end of the
day. Right.
True.
Right.
True.
And it's not the same guy necessarily.
Exactly.
And it's usually not their fault, right?
No.
If they don't win, it's never their fault, right?
Sure.
It's the car, the driver, the track.
Yeah.
Anyway, but they really liked Belle Isle. But I go back to the vibrancy and the fan base and everything else downtown. Belle Isle was a wonderful place for all those years. But you really missed that vibrancy of downtown.
Mm-hmm.
You could be sitting at a patio bar downtown and not even realize there was anything going on Belle Isle. It's just
might
as well have been 20 miles away.
Exactly.
Right? It's so close to the city, but it's so far. So downtown, it is right in the middle of it. The drivers stay right downtown. They walk to dinner downtown.
Right.
You know, it's just a different feel.
Yeah. Well, it's fantastic. And what I love about the actual racing in and of itself is it just feels like such a deep roster. Like everybody could win. Like and then you go off of what happened last weekend at Indy, you come here, you do something totally different, but it just feels like there are so many good drivers that could threaten for that podium.
Yeah, I mean, in IndyCar, that's absolutely true,
yeah.
For sure. I mean, I think it's kind of like that in IMSA and Next, but you really see the depth in IndyCar. Like, the field is separated by tenths of a second,
right?
And that can make one little mistake, one little bobble. You put a wheel wrong,
mm-hmm.
and now you go from first to 15th,
right?
But it a course like this, you know, typically you think about street courses, they're hard to pass, it's hard to make up ground, but people have a way of doing that here,
yeah.
Right? And this course can, if you make one of those mistakes, again,
right.
You can go from first to 15th,
right.
And 15th to first, and that split second. So we've seen that, and I think that's one of the allures about this course as well.
It's all part of the excitement. It's so wonderful to see you, Michael Montri, Merrill Kane. Well done, and we look forward to next year.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for all your partnership, too. You guys have been great.
You got it. More coming up. All right, good to have you. 7 o'clock hour here on a Monday. Alex Palou wins the Chevrolet Detroit Grand Prix presented by Lear. It's the fourth win of the season for him. It's the fourth consecutive year where it's been back downtown. And much like this morning, that it's absolutely beautiful. It was beautiful this weekend.
It was. And even leading up to the weekend, it was pretty nice as well, which also helps when you're putting together something like the Grand Prix because, you know, you got to have – you got vendors and things that you have to erect and all of that. And if the weather is great, it makes it easier.
Yeah, if it's raining in 40, it becomes
I want to deal with that.
A whole different thing. Alex Palou takes the checkered flag. Kyle Kirkwood finished second, and Graham Rahal finishing third here in Detroit. And just an absolutely wonderful event. Tons of different passes. 173 on the day yesterday. I mean, it was an exciting race, as it usually is here.
All the grandstands sold out. I'm sure the restaurants did very well. You know, a lot of walkability, you know, when you're downtown in the streets and stuff. And,
yes.
You know, so it's just a great place.
Yeah, it was a great place. Meanwhile, they got to figure something else out at DTW because now for the second time in 4 months, somebody's crashed into a terminal.
Yeah, and this time it was a 67-year-old man. He's in custody. He crashed into the Evans terminal on Friday morning. Investigators say the driver entered the wrong way near door 4, then maneuvered through gaps in security barriers, drove up onto the sidewalk, and then crashed through the terminal doors before stopping just short of the TSA checkpoint. Airport police responded within seconds. No injuries reported. Officials say the man later made some bizarre statements. After he was detained, he claimed he was at the airport to meet actor Tom Cruise and to save his dad. Neighbors in Southgate told investigators they witnessed hours of erratic behavior before the crash, including the man throwing objects into neighboring yards overnight. Several residents said police were called earlier but initially found him on his own property. Temporary concrete barriers have now been installed at the terminal. Authorities say the investigation is ongoing and charges have not yet been announced. But this really seems like some type of mental breakdown that happened, and something's going to have to be done when it comes to barricading, you know, these doors at the airport. You never would have thought that you have to worry about a car going through the airport, you know, but this is the second time.
Yeah, now it's something that has happened.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe the first time is an aberration. Okay, now this time is something a little different. Now, I mean, again, it doesn't sound like either of these were necessarily purposeful or with the intent to hurt people. It wasn't an attack, but it happened.
Yeah, and people could get hurt.
Correct.
Luckily, they didn't at this one.
Yeah, you know, correct. So. Meanwhile, the United States and Iran traded attacks over the last 24 hours as this, you know, the discussions for a long-lasting ceasefire continues. The deal that they currently have in place is just hanging on by a thread. U.S. military officials said late yesterday that it attacked radar and command sites in southern Iran over the weekend. They also, this was in retaliation for Iran shooting down an American drone in the area. Fighter jets attacked Iran air defenses, among other sites, according to U.S. officials, all while the conversations continue. The president has tendered his resignation in Iran to the supreme leader. There's been no indication on whether or not that resignation letter has been accepted by Mujtaba Bahamani. But the conversations are ongoing. The memorandum of understanding is still floating around out there. So there's a lot of balls in the air currently in this situation.
A civil liberties group is raising constitutional concern over Michigan State University's new Board of Trustees Code of Ethics and Conduct, calling it a possible violation of the First Amendment. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known as FIRE, says the policy requires trustees to support majority board decisions and restricts their ability to publicly criticize university actions or speak freely to constituents. The group argues the rules approved in a 5-3 vote could punish dissenting trustees through sanctions such as losing access to events, reimbursements, and legal support if they refuse to sign a required loyalty statement. Two trustees say they were even barred from certain university-related activities after declining to agree to the new code. FIRE is urging MSU to revise the policy, warning it could chill public debate over how one of Michigan's largest public universities is governed.
Interesting.
So, you know, we'll see. I mean, and what they've said, what FIRE have said, is something I've heard kind of quietly, that this could be a possible violation of First Amendment. But, you know, FIRE's come out publicly now and said, yeah, they think this is what it is. So we'll see.
Mm. Coming up on the other side, Kaylin Dorr, the White House Deputy Communications Director, will join us. There's been a lot of talk around declassifying UAP information from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And aliens.gov then made an appearance last week, although it's not what
you
think.
Not the aliens that you think.
It's I'll tell you, it's not what I wanted.
I know it's not what you want. I know what you
as
want.
As we're talking about technology and aircrafts and this video that military members are getting while they're flying up in jets, I was looking for something a little different, but we got
little
something
green
else.
Man is what you're looking for.
We'll talk to. I don't know that they're green. I don't know. What do you assume?
Little Martian. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. Kalen Dorr joins us on the other side, but first at 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Many business owners have yet to adopt and deploy influencer and or creator marketing campaigns, but they should be, and many are. The Interactive Advertising Bureau estimates that the creator economy grew at about 26% year over year from last year to this year, and that's four times faster than the media industry overall. And for good reason, it's working. And now not only are businesses investing more in those campaigns, they're amplifying those campaigns by boosting them. A long-standing practice in creator and influencer marketing in which brands devote part of their media budget to juicing the performance of their influencer activity in order to achieve greater reach and greater overall success with their campaigns. As reported in Digiday.com, an online publication devoted to marketing, had this to say, brand spending on social video is accelerating rapidly. And one major contributing factor could be the practice of amplifying influencer video content on platforms like Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube by boosting these campaigns with additional funding as they're released. These boosting or amplification budgets have a wide range, starting down in the low thousands of dollars and reaching up into $5 million and more, according to one influencer expert. And now it's not just an afterthought, it's actually integrated into the campaign itself, says Olivia Cripps, global paid media director at influencer and social media agency Billion Dollar Boy. She highlighted two global retail clients who have increased their budgets by 79% and 253%, respectively, underscoring the effectiveness of these campaigns. So if you're looking to add an effective marketing tactic to your campaigns, try influencer or creator campaigns as they're known and set aside budget to add in order to boost these campaigns once they're proving effective. It's a tactic that's seeing more and more of the marketing department's budgets these days. And again, that's for good reason. They're working. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So last week, aliens.gov was rolled out.
Yes.
And I was very excited.
I know you were.
I clicked on it, and it was a...
Say what?
Yeah, it was a very X-Files vibe.
Uh-huh.
I was like, woo. I was very excited.
Yes.
But then they were just talking about illegal aliens that have come into the country and all the work done on immigration.
Yes.
That the president talked about throughout the campaign, mm-hmm. early in his second term here, and the work that's been done on that. Kalen Dorr is the White House Deputy Communications Director and joins us this morning to talk about it. Kalen, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Hey, good morning, guys. How's it been?
Well, it's been good. I got to be honest, I was a little disappointed. you guys pulled the okie doke on me. I was excited to see some of this declassification, but you guys went a different route with aliens.gov.
Well, that's right. We've been doing declassifications and releasing alien files in tranches for about 2 months now, a month, month and a half. So, and just because we got some folks this go around doesn't mean that there's nothing to look forward to. And that's what I've been telling a lot of folks that feel the same way you do. But we had to get the mainstream media, we had to get everybody talking about all the hard work we're doing. The southern border is absolutely secure. And the point of the site is to illustrate that, when you think about it, I feel like there's some malaise. People think that the immigration problem in our country is simply a border state issue. And that's just not, quite simply not the case. So we thought this is a pretty important thing to do. And I love me a good troll every once in a while.
You know, Kaylin, you know, the administration has defended the site as a way to, you know, draw eyeballs to the border security concern. In today's digital age, do you think government agencies have to think more like marketers to break through all the noise?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, there's this attention deficit economy that we're currently working with, right? And you're fighting with so many different things for eyeballs, for clicks, for you know, attention. It's probably our greatest currency in the country right now. And so, you know, we want people to be spending their time with us. We want people to be spending their time, you know, just looking for the answers to and solutions for all of their problems, because you know, there's a lot of fake news and misinformation out there, and it really behooves us to cut around, like I said, the mainstream media, the legacy media, and to do things like, you know, call into local radio, for example, to, you know, perform some of these marketing stunts. Because if we don't meet the American public where they are, they're never going to find us. And the previous administration was basically asking people to come to them. That's not the case. We want to go into the communities. We want to make sure what we're doing is something that everybody is talking about. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that so far. There's always more to be done. There's always more trolling to be done. But this administration is fully committed to being crazy transparent. And we launched an app about 2 months ago. It hit 2 million users and under like 10 days, because people are curious for this kind of thing. They're ferociously consuming content, consuming information. So if you're not actively doing things like this, then I don't know what you're doing. You're not really committed to the job. So
sure. I mean, look,
having fun doing it.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's a different way of doing it.
Sure.
We have not seen something like this before. Is there a concern, though, then with information that you release at a later date that it might become diluted or people become skeptical of it based on something like this?
I don't think so. If only because there's always another, you know, stunt to pull. I would just keep your ears open, keep your eyes open for, you know, the next thing that we end up doing. I know we've got the team has got a lot of really good ideas on how to properly communicate this, but I don't feel that way at all. I feel like when things are ready to be released, you will know about it, and we'll be back here talking about it yet again, because it's something that you're interested in, and we'll be making content to make sure it gets in your feed and in your in front of you. So we're excited to cross that bridge when we get to it.
And Kaylin, the administration, I know, has set some ambitious deportation goals and expanded detention capacity. What does success look like, let's say, a year from now? I mean, is it measured by numbers alone, or are there some other benchmarks?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think it just it kind of depends on how well things go here. We're starting with obviously the most violent offenders, some of the illegal criminal aliens that, you know, I think you and myself and your mother and father, everyone in your family can kind of agree, you know, probably shouldn't be in our neighborhoods. And I think that is something that our administration has been really good at fighting the messaging battle on. As you know, I'll never forget, sorry, I had a interview or a meeting with some legacy media executives about a year ago, and we had redecorated the front lawn with some mugshots of some illegal criminals, some pedophiles, rapists, and they were so upset that we would do that. And, oh my God, the humanity of these people. The humanity, and I looked at this person and I said, humanity, they murdered, you know, four kids, or you know, they raped a family. Like, what are you even talking about? Mm. And we know that we win that messaging battle every time. It's good. It's making people's neighborhoods safer. And it's something that the left can't help but defend, albeit it's wildly indefensible.
Kaylin Dorr, always appreciate your time. Thank you. And when you're ready to unleash more of the UAP stuff, you let us know.
Yeah, I'm on it. We'll get that to you ASAP.
You got okay, it. Thank you. That's Kaylin Dorr, the Deputy Communications Director at the White House. Thank you for your time. But again, you know, what's interesting is you hear that's the perspective.
Yeah.
Right? A viral moment, a moment to get into your feed, something that is certainly different. And that's something that this administration, even going back to the campaign, did. That was completely different.
Always
right, going
different.
On Joe Rogan, going on some of these different outlets where there's a lot of eyeballs, completely different, completely way of thinking about how to get information out there. It's fascinating whether you like it or not.
It is, and they're using the digital age right now, you know, fully.
Absolutely, absolutely. Coming up on the other side, the Texas Senate race is setting the pace in terms of midterm battles. How does it play out? How does it have other impacts on other races around the country? It's next. I've been so interested out of in this Senate story out of the state of Texas. James Tallarico and Ken Paxton going to go at it after Paxton beat John Cornyn.
Yes.
In the runoff. And and you throw all of that incumbency, all of that goodwill amongst your base that you had over the years, it goes away. And John Cornyn had been a pretty strong supporter of Donald Trump's policy. And voted accordingly in many instances, but they had a falling out, and Donald Trump then supported Ken Paxton, who succeeded in the primary runoff in the state of Texas. And now this anti-woke agenda, as Zachary Basso writes in Axios, is going to face the ultimate test for the GOP in Texas. But then how does that impact other races? How does that impact the Senate race here in the state of Michigan? Jason Rose, the founder and principal of Rose Strategic, and joins us this morning. Jason, it's good to talk with you. It was good to see you up on the island the other day.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We had some great weather. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this. James Tallarico doesn't come without baggage. He has called God non-binary among a number of issues, which is not going to play well in the state of Texas.
I think he said he was sorry for saying that now. He's trying to pull it back. Now.
Yes, but make no mistake about it. I mean, Ken Paxton has ethical issues, legal baggage that comes along with him, too. How are the GOP looking at that particular race under the microscope?
Well, first, thank God none of us live in Texas.
Agreed.
These two. We got a complete weirdo and a complete dirtbag on both sides. So I'm grateful to have some good choices here in Michigan. I don't think, in spite of what a flawed candidate Ken Paxton is, that Texas is at risk. And in part, it is the long list of bizarre commentaries coming from Tallarico. I mean, you mentioned the non-binary, God's non-binary. There's six sexes, not two. He refers to women as neighbors with uteruses. He supports an open southern border, said it should be like our front porch, welcoming. Calls the American flag a complicated symbol. And then at the same time says illegal immigrants are the most patriotic people. And I'm not disputing that immigrants are patriotic, but I'm pretty darn patriotic. And I think most native-born Americans are pretty darn patriotic. He announced that his is going to be the first meat-free campaign. This is in the state of Texas, the biggest cattle producer in the country, because, of course, climate change. So, you know, the list on Paxton is equally long on things that, you know, might be considered discrediting. But this is so far out of the mainstream, and Texas is still Texas. And so I don't think the seat is at risk. But, you know, Chris, you mentioned how does that impact Michigan? Well, it's going to impact Michigan because it is going to cost a lot more to win a safe red seat than it should. You know, we're going to see hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the Republican side to push Paxton through. And that's money that's going to be diverted from pickup opportunities like Michigan, Georgia, New Hampshire, and other really important protect races like North Carolina. And right now, even Iowa is looking a little bit dicey. So it's a problem. It's a self-inflicted problem. President Trump, you know, created this problem, and it is going to complicate things moving forward and holding the Senate for Republicans.
Jason, conversely, if Republicans win comfortably in Texas, does that quiet some of the national chatter about a Democratic path to the Senate majority?
Well, it's hard to predict. I mean, I think, you know, Iran hangs over everything, and it's not so much the conflict, it's the impact on us domestically. It is the, you know, $4 and $5 gallon of gasoline. It is the impact on groceries. And there was some news over the weekend that we're going to see a jolt in our grocery prices. And so until Iran is sorted out and the Strait of Hormuz is open and the flow of oil out of the region resumes, we're facing pretty strong headwinds. And we all know, we've discussed it many times, we are historically in a bad cycle. The midterms of a president's second term are, I think 18 to 20 times have favored the opposition party. And so we face those headwinds. I do feel good about the money we've raised. And, other than Paxton and some other isolated candidates, I think there's better candidate quality for Republicans. So I'm still optimistic we hold the Senate. I think the House is a little bit dicier, but if we don't get Iran settled soon, we're going to have some real challenges moving forward.
You talk about the money that's going to be spent in some of the areas now that are going to draw focus for funding. Does the National Republican Senatorial Committee, do they look at it and go, well, hold on, we need to make sure that we're diverting resources to seats that we have to try to hold, as opposed to trying to fund seats that they are trying to flip or win?
Well, this is not a sentimental business. Polling is going to dictate resources. And, there's probably a half dozen Senate seats that Republicans are focused on. And so as things progress and, the head-to-heads in these states start to come together, they will make merit-based decisions. If they see a candidate is not going to be able to get over the top, they may pull those resources and redirect them somewhere else. If a candidate has a comfortable lead, they may pull resources and move them somewhere else. But we're talking about between the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the Senate Leadership Fund, the super PAC that is aligned with the NRSC, we're probably talking about $500 to $600 million in spending in this election cycle. Wow. With some very expensive states to compete in. So it's going to be, very lucrative for political consultants that are doing U.S. Senate races. That's for sure.
Could Texas become the race that determines not just Senate control, Jason, but the kind of like the tone and direction of the entire 26 midterm cycle?
I don't genuinely feel that Texas is at risk, is bad.
Yeah, no, I would agree. It doesn't feel like they're at risk. But again, you look at where Cornyn was pulling against Tallarico and where
right.
Paxton was pulling against Tallarico, two very different issues. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the problem for Democrats is they fall in love with candidates that are popular online and not with the electorate. And,
sure.
To Republicans' credit, we got to stay focused on people that are IRL in real life. And so I think James Tallarico is a Democratic fantasy that just doesn't jive with the culture of Texas.
Yeah.
And so I don't see him getting much traction.
Jason Rowe, always great insight. Thank you. We'll talk again very soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
He mentioned gas being one of the main impetuses for how people may vote mm-hmm. in this midterm cycle. Interesting story out of CNN. How Costco can sell gas so cheap. And I imagine it's probably pretty similar to any of these big box stores that
like I go to BJ's and
all gas, no brakes, money.
I assume it's probably the exact same thing.
Sure.
But Costco can sell cheaper gas because they don't really care about making money on the gas.
Mm-mm.
They make a couple of cents on each gallon of gas sold, but the studies that have been done that show about half of customers that go get gas at a Costco also then go inside.
Yeah, the gas is the hook.
The gas is the hook.
Yeah.
And they make their money off the memberships. They make their money. I mean, it's the same principle as why they can sell you a hot dog and a pop for $1.50.
$1.25 or $1.50 or something,
yeah.
Right.
Same principle.
Yeah.
They just want to get you in the door. Also doesn't help that it's cheaper gas and good hot dogs.
Actually, I've gone to Costco and just got a hot dog.
Of course. I think we all have.
Or a slice of pizza or
ain't
something.
No shame
yeah.
in my game. Coming up next, you were at an event this weekend, Walk for Mental Health, with the Detroit Wayne Health DWIN.
Yes.
And they, you were able to catch up with the head of DWIN.
Yes, the former police chief, James White, who's now the CEO and president.
And we'll talk to him coming up on the other side. It's JR Morning. It's WJR's Tim McGraw VIP Experience. It's your chance to rock when country music legend Tim McGraw brings his Pawn Show Guitar Tour to Pinon Music Theater August 28th, and you could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of Metro Cars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza. To enter, download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0957. That's 800-859-0957. More information is on WJR.com. It's going to be a good one.
It is. I emceed an event over the weekend for DWAN, mm-hmm. the Detroit Wayne Integrated Health Network, and I spoke with James White, who is the president and CEO of DWAN, following that first annual Walk for Mental Health. It took place at O'Hare Park. That's in northwest Detroit, right around 7 Mile and Southfield. And the event, you know, brought together, you know, residents, families, community partners. The chief of police was there. The sheriff of Wayne County was there. And it was really a day focused on awareness and wellness and connection around mental health. And I began the interview with Chief White asking him what he had hoped to accomplish with the mental health walk.
Well, you know, destigmatizing mental health. I mean, it is amazing how we treat the head like it's not attached to the body when it comes to mental health, right? I mean, could you imagine someone with a twisted ankle or a broken leg not seeking treatment or being marginalized if they did seek treatment, right? I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous that that's the case. And what our goal is to say, listen, you're not alone. This isn't a partisan issue. This isn't a black-white issue. This isn't male-female issue. This is an us and we issue. Everybody has somebody in their lives that's dealing with a behavioral health issue. And sometimes we're dealing with a behavioral health issue that we know we're dealing with, but we won't get it addressed. And so what we want with this is to let you know you're not alone. We've got services for you. They're private services, but these are services to help you return to yourself.
Talk about the partnership you have with the Detroit Police Department and the sheriff.
Listen, I in 30 years as a police a member of the police department and the last four as chief, you make relationships. And coming over to DWIN from those relationships that I have with DWIN and getting this opportunity to lead this amazing organization, I wasn't going to leave those relationships behind. I mean, the Chief Bettison is doing an amazing job, and he's all about mental health and behavioral health services for the people who need it most. He's the first to tell you we're not going to be able to arrest our way out of crime. There are other issues that are affecting people's decision-making, and why don't we have more services so people don't have to end up in a jail cell?
And there is a way now for people, when they call 911, they could get transferred right over to you guys if they're having some type of mental issue.
Let me tell you something. This is... when you talk about being blessed and having innovative people around you, one of my team leads, Vice President Grace Wolf, put together a program where nonviolent people in crisis, and the emphasis is on nonviolent people in crisis, when they call 911, there's a screening process. And if they're determined to be nonviolent, the police don't even come. You know who comes? DWIN. We come out with our mobile crisis. We deliver those services that they need most, and we get them to our crisis center if necessary. And believe it or not, about half of them don't even need to go to the crisis center. They're able to get stabilized and stay in their homes with their families and know that there's resources available and follow-up resources available to them to make sure that they stay on their meds or get the services that they need from one of our providers.
Help that's coming to the Sheriff's Department. I know they're being trained, but also the sheriff has said before that he runs the largest mental health facility in the state. It shouldn't be that way. You guys are building a new facility right here in Northwest Detroit, 7 Mile Road, that's going to really be helpful, not only to the community, but to the Sheriff's Department as well.
It is, and this is a 52-bed facility. 16 of those beds are dedicated to youth. So we've got beds for youth that are in crisis that can get the CSU services that they need. And that's very important. This is the first of its kind in the state, too. I mean, this is not something that happens, you know, every few years. This is the first of its kind, and we've got the right team in place to give people a chance to return to their lives. But I'm most impressed with the ability to help the young kids. That's what touches my heart the most because, you know, everyone in mental health crisis needs the services, but the kids are even more confused about where they are, and the stigma for them is even greater because they're dealing with other kids who may not understand what they're dealing with.
And you have an existing facility in the new center area, right?
We do. 707 Milwaukee, they've been open since 2024. 4,000 plus people have been serviced already. Now we're opening up at 7 Mile between Evergreen and Southfield. And let me say this, densely populated area of the city of Detroit, northwest side of the city of Detroit. you're going to have just to our north, Southfield, Michigan, to our south, Dearborn, to our west, Redford, and to our east, Dearborn Heights. So you've got a situation here where we could see those numbers grow exponentially in a short amount of time. But we're happy to be there, happy to do it. There's no wrong door at DWIN. So if you don't have money, you don't have resources, but you need help, come see us. We're not going to worry about payment. We recognize that some people will be Medicaid eligible. We'll get you lined up for that if necessary. But if you don't have any finances, you're still going to get some services. No wrong door at DWIN.
You guys always deal with people with substance abuse, and I've read recently that overdoses have been going down. Yes. So you guys help in making sure that happens.
Yeah, and our substance use disorder board and that team led by our director does an incredible job of getting these services, working with our over 100 providers in the substance use disorder space to ensure that programs are being put on, training is being put on, Narcan training. We're going out to churches and schools and providing that Narcan training, but we're also doing preventative training too. We want to erase this notion that marijuana use is just nothing. I mean, it's still a problem in our community. And when you have people who have access to gateway drugs, it doesn't stop there. Then you have a situation, unfortunately, where if people are dealing with a behavioral health or substance use disorder issue. These drugs serve as a self-medicating model for them, and people don't really understand that. When you start waking up to marijuana or gummies, and you spend your whole day in some degree of intoxication, and then when trouble comes, and it comes for all of us, your functionality or your ability to deal with it may be somewhat subdued, or you may overreact depending on how the substance is treating your body.
This has been a success, I'm sure. This is the first one. This won't be the last one.
After this turnout, I can tell you most assuredly, it will not be the last.
All right. CEO James White, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And Chris, if someone is seeking help or they want to talk to someone, they can call this number, 1-800-241-4949. That's 24/7, 365. Also, they have a new interactive website as well. It is dwin.org, D-W-I-H-N.org.
Not D-W-H-I-N, as I wrote it down.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's a wonderful thing. They're doing wonderful work.
They are.
Thank God they're out there doing that work. We'll get you caught up on the headlines. Also, Jamie in the next hour. It's next. All right, welcome back. 8 o'clock hour. May your coffee be light, or your coffee be strong, and your traffic be light.
Oh, okay. I can deal with that.
Right?
I don't drink coffee, but tea for
tea?
Me.
Tea for you?
Me.
All right,
yes.
Very good.
Okay.
It's a nice Monday downtown. Absolutely beautiful. It was a beautiful weekend.
Man, you could not, weather-wise, you just could not beat it.
I mean, it's pretty darn good, and it was pretty darn good for the Chevrolet Detroit Grand Prix presented by Lear. Alex Palou went and dominated that race. He got the checkered flag and won it. And he really likes these street courses.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was, again, a dominating end for him. Led for 71 laps of that thing. I mean, he was really dialed into that. And Kirkland finished second. And I believe it was Ray Hall in third. Just the views, how it came across television. I did want to go down this weekend. Unfortunately, we just couldn't make it happen.
Yeah.
But it was, the way it came across TV was absolutely spectacular.
Well, the city has really been shining. And, I think the city is just becoming a place where people want to come and have these big events. I know we've had the Grand Prix year over year, but even some new events will be coming here. And I think it's
because Final Four's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's because what has been done and the how great the city looks and, how the city takes care of these big events when they come here.
Well, and what the tough part for Detroit has been is to crack through, the Indianapolis,
yes.
Chicago, New Orleans, L.A., New York, these areas where they are traditionally and frequently hosting big events.
Yes.
When you get to that level and you're the new kid on the block,
yeah,
right? It,
yeah.
It can be tough to get that ball rolling, but there is no doubt the ball is rolling.
Oh, we have the momentum.
Yeah.
We definitely do.
Yeah. So it was really, really a great weekend of racing, not even just yesterday afternoon. I mean, all weekend.
All weekend.
Unbelievable races downtown. Yeah. And it just looked absolutely fantastic. So I'm just so proud of all of the people that do this work and get the job done, and then how they make our city look is very cool.
And they, I mean, they're planning now for next year.
Yeah.
You know, they start tomorrow. Yeah. Plan for next year.
Got to get on it early. Got to get an early jump.
But that's why it turns out so nice.
Yeah, no doubt. Meanwhile, for the second time in 4 months, we've got an incident at Detroit Metro.
We
got
to really watch out for this. This time it's a 67-year-old man who is in custody. He crashed an SUV through the Evans Terminal on Friday morning, and it's just a startling incident. Investigators say the driver entered the wrong way near door number 4. He maneuvered through the gaps in security barriers, drove up onto the sidewalk, and crashed through terminal doors before stopping just short of the TSA checkpoint. Airport police responded within seconds. No injuries were reported. Thank God for that. Officials say that the man later made bizarre statements after being detained, claiming he was at the airport to meet actor Tom Cruise and to save his dad. And neighbors in Southgate told investigators they witnessed hours of erratic behavior before the crash, including the man throwing objects into neighboring yards overnight. Temporary concrete barriers have now been installed at the terminal, and authorities say the investigation is ongoing. No charges have been announced as of yet, but I'm sure there will be some type of mental health evaluation for this person, because that seems like what this is part of.
Meanwhile, on the Iran front, fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon certainly has escalated further. And one of the things that Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, warned that the hostilities could rattle the U.S.-Iran ceasefire that began in April. He said the ceasefire between Iran and the U.S. is unequivocally a ceasefire on all fronts, including Lebanon. Its violation on one front is a violation on the ceasefire on all fronts. Although Israel and Hezbollah, the proxy terrorist group operated by Tehran, they've been going at each other for weeks now.
They have, yeah.
And there hasn't been any sort of prompting by the Iranian government to continue the war with the United States on their front. So that to me sounds like a bit of a tough talk without anything behind it. Meanwhile, there was some strikes traded between the United States and Iran. A drone was shot down. The United States went in this particular instance, some low-level strikes on some different areas, some different missile launching areas, nothing substantial.
Yeah.
But again, this is all as the ceasefire is
still fragile to me, man.
It is just really hanging on by a thread.
It is.
All while the discussions are going on.
And negotiations are happening, yeah.
Yeah, so we don't have anything for certain, but Donald Trump says that Iran wants to make a deal. We've heard that before. We've heard that for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just not at that point yet. So that's problematic in the sense that we don't have a deal done yet, even though they are still working towards something. The idea of, well, Iran potentially agreeing to not building a nuclear weapon, but maybe buying one on the back end, kind of usurping the discussion. So all of these things are at play, and that's something that the president is watching closely.
Shoppers alert. Shoppers at major retailers nationwide being warned about an expanding food recall tied to a powdered milk contamination issue and concerns over possible salmonella exposure. Costco, Kroger, Walmart, Target, Publix, and more than 20 other chains have pulled products linked to the recall, including Motor City Pizza Company, 5 Cheese Bread made by Champion Foods. The company says multiple production dates of both single and two-pack items are affected. The issue traces back to California Dairy's powdered milk and buttermilk, which was distributed in bulk to manufacturers and has now triggered dozens of downstream recalls as federal agencies continue tracking impacted products. Champion Foods says no contamination has been found in the cheese bread and no illnesses have been reported, calling the recall a precaution. Consumers are urged not to eat the affected product and can return it for a full refund.
Hmm. Good to know. Meanwhile, the Tigers yesterday, lost 2-1 to the White Sox. They
took a gamble and
swept in that series, but Keider Montero was yanked after allowing just 2 hits in 6 shutout innings. Detroit lost for the 21st time in 25 games, and they just can't buy a couple of wins together. No,
how far are they below 500 now? Like 16?
16 games below 500.
Tied with the Rockies for the worst record in baseball.
But they do have the worst record in the American League. Well.
But you know what? Dave Rieger said something.
To the bottom.
He did find one positive yesterday. He said they're only 7 games out of the wild card.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
If that's a positive. I don't know.
Don't dangle that carrot in front of us.
By the end of this week, it could be 12.
Exactly right. Yeah, and look, Keiter Montero was dealing yesterday. And that's now a couple in a row that he's had that he's pitched really well.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there were reports. I think it was – I don't remember who it was. I'd have to go back and look. But there are these reports. I don't know if you saw it, Jason, that the Tigers are now seriously considering dealing Tarek Skubal.
I would hope so.
I mean, I don't know what you do at this point.
Probably time.
Yeah, he's supposed to – I know Verlander has a rehab assignment Tuesday. I don't know how much help that is going to be. But Skubal
is
supposed –
It's another body at least.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Skubal is supposed to have a rehab assignment coming up, they're saying now middle of June.
It is incredibly
quick. So you
get
him back on the mound, you showcase him and see what you can get, I guess.
Yeah, you give him one start. If he pitches decent, you deal him. I don't know. But you're not going to get as much. I mean, the value of is down a little
it's
bit
down.
Because of the injury, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Coming up on the other side, Jamie rejoins us. We're going to talk about the newest episode of her podcast. It's out now. It's coming up on JR Morning. Well, it's nice to hear Jamie back at it.
Yes.
Filling in for Paul W. on Focus with Paul W. Smith on Friday.
Mm-hmm. I saw a picture. She looked good, too.
Yep. Jamie, hi. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Yeah, it was fun leaning into the race car driving and sports aspect.
Yeah, it was very cool. So how are things? The new episode of the pod is out. It's very good.
Yes.
So this one is my husband, and we thought, you know, if we're going to put it all out there, let's talk to the caregiver in the house and the husband and the dad and how he's stepping up a little bit. And I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, we enjoyed it. And you know, I could really relate to it a little bit as well, because I remember, you know, when my wife, Marie, who is a breast cancer survivor, you know, called me from the doctor's office, you know, and told me that she had cancer and was crying. And it was a shock to me. And it's like the caregiver, you know, they have a certain emotion that they go through as well that we don't really hear about much. And I'm glad you brought this out. And, you know, you and Ryan had that conversation. It was really a touching and really heartfelt conversation you guys had about all kinds of things, really.
Yeah, it's all kinds of things. But, yeah, Lloyd, you talk about those early moments and sort of how he navigated those early moments with the news that shocked us both. And here's a little clip. Let's go back to that phone call that we got on February 10th. I talked about it on episode one. You work from home. I've been waiting for this call. I run down the stairs. I put it on speaker. And she says those words that it's cancerous. It's positive for cancer. I remember looking at you. Your face, you look like a ghost. What were you thinking in that moment?
Fear. What's going to happen next? What do we do from here? I remember more leading up to it, right? I remember the weekend before and the time leading up to it and being really nervous about it, but not that nervous about it because you talk to your doctor and they said, do you drink a lot of caffeine? It's probably just a cyst. Lauren, former podcast guest, was telling you she'd had similar scares. Other people were telling you they'd had similar scares. So no family history. I was expecting a cyst or, you know, some type of better news than what we got. I was not expecting to hear what we heard. And when we did, it was just shock, you know, and fear to start.
I mean, I broke down in tears like immediately. And it was like I was having an out of body experience. I couldn't believe this was my life. And I couldn't formulate words. You were able to formulate words and ask questions of the person on the other line, the nurse who was calling. How did you do that?
Reflex, right? I ask questions all the time. That's what I do for a living. And you know, once we knew when she said you had cancer, there was a lot of questions for me. You were, you know, distraught and I just went into what I do or my mode and just wanted to gather information and see what questions they could answer for us at that point. Just you know, just scared and wanting to know whatever they knew or could share at that time was really just how I reacted in that moment. Mm-hmm. But reflex, right? Like I just started asking questions.
I feel like that was your role that whole week, because the next day, I forget who it was, whether it's a PA or a medical assistant or something, they call you to give you even more information. Remember it was on FaceTime.
Right.
My parents were here. You had more questions then.
Right.
Then the next day after that, we met the oncologist for the first time, Dr. Lutfi at Henry Ford. And again, I'm still like very emotional about what's happening to me, and you were asking the right questions, and I'm grateful to that.
Yeah. Well, another thing is like professionally, like I've done medical malpractice cases. I did asbestos litigation for many years, which involves lung cancer and mesothelioma. So I've read a lot of pathology reports. I'm not in by any stretch of a cancer expert, but I know some things about cancer through, you know, professional work that I've done. And I was just, again, just asking questions that I want to know the answer to and that I thought were relevant for, you know, purposes of the upcoming treatment that you had and stuff that we'd want to know. And at that point, you were still in like a really, really like dark place and probably not ready to just start asking questions and more taking in information. So, I mean, it's just kind of what I resorted to and wanting to gather and know as much information as we could from the people that they were giving to us and that we had an opportunity to speak with in terms of doctors or social workers or nurses or whoever, you know, was talking to us about what was going on at that time.
And you know me, you know what I can handle and not. And like the prognosis, the statistics of how this cancer, you know, reacts and how people do with it. You knew I didn't need to know that information. There was a moment with the oncologist where you're kind of like, we don't need to know that part.
Well, that's because your mom started asking inappropriate questions in your presence and like wanting statistics on prognosis, on survival rate, on things that like you were not prepared to hear at that time and that you had told her you didn't want to ask or hear. And she went rogue and started asking those questions. And I just told the doctor, like, don't answer that question right now. We'll talk to you about that later because you were 1-2 days into, you know, this incredibly terrible news. And it wasn't a good time for you to hear that. And it wasn't going to change anything, right? Those statistics in many ways don't do you any good at this time. Your case is your case, right?
I am me with my biology.
Right.
So mom went rogue, huh?
Yep. But, you know, Ryan was like, okay, not right now with that question. And so I appreciated him so much and still do, of course, but like in those early moments.
Sure.
Well, it was a very raw, emotional conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which again for me was different. Lloyd, you've had a little bit of experience with this, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie, you guys are going through it. We have not gone through anything like this. And I would never even think about the caregiver side of this, the spouse's side, the partner side of this and some of the things that you go through. And one of the things I thought was really sweet was you were talking about an upcoming trip that he had planned with some of his friends. And I would never even think about that. But you were like, no, it's important that you also get away. You get a little bit of a respite from this. I thought it was touching, quite frankly.
Mm. Well, yeah, there's no break from this. Like this has been our whole life for, you know, however long now. So like if we can find little moments of normalcy, we try. And we try to just be as honest as possible. It's not all that serious either on this podcast. We talk about a Texas Roadhouse situation.
Oh, Texas Roadhouse was hilarious.
I know.
Oh,
you actually made me want to go to Texas Roadhouse. I haven't had Texas Roadhouse. Those rolls are off the charts. Yeah.
Are unbelievable.
They are.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
so, anyway, it was just fun to have them. And I'm so glad that you guys are listening. And I hope it brings something to others out there listening.
I've talked to people that are like, so
myself
into this.
Yes.
Because
and are appreciative.
Appreciative. And again, they're getting stuff that they didn't think that they would get.
Right.
Information that they didn't expect. And I think that's one of the cool parts about this.
Well, thank you guys, both of you, for your support. And this week we're going to do, I think it's Gilda's Club, a place where you can get a lot of support if you're a cancer survivor or
awesome.
Person going through it.
That's wonderful.
That's great.
Love you, Jamie.
Yep. We
love
you.
You guys.
Thank you.
See ya.
We'll talk later in the week. Jamie Edmonds.
Okay.
It's good to always have her on. I mean, any chance we can get.
It's Chris, Lloyd, and Jamie, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. All right, coming up on the other side, how exactly did Stephen Colbert end up on Monroe Public Access? We'll examine. Well, we talked about it after Stephen Colbert's run on The Late Show came to an end on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. On a Friday, he was back on television. He was back on television at Monroe Community Media as a callback to 2015, mm-hmm. 11 years ago, when he did a program only in Monroe.
Yes.
And he called it back. Steve Buscemi was in it talking about, like, Buscemi's pizza.
Uh-huh.
When he was, like, giving the stamp of approval because it's Buscemi's pizza.
Buscemi's, yeah.
Jack White, Eminem made an appearance mm-hmm. again. So it was very cool. My question has always been, well, how did this happen? How did Stephen Colbert again end up back on TV in Monroe? Brian Burchette is the media coordinator at Monroe Community Media and joins us this morning. Brian, it's good to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What a way to draw attention to Monroe Community Media, huh?
Well, it's been quite an experience, that's for sure.
How did all of this play out? How did all of it start?
Well, it started back in 2015, of course, when Colbert came, before he was on the CBS Late Show, before it even really existed, we knew it was happening. He wanted to get a little preview of what it was like to do a show and came to Monroe, selected us completely out of the blue. And it was funny because when we heard his show was ending, we said, wouldn't it be hilarious if when his show ended, he decided to come back? Lo and behold, we got a phone call. It was very quick.
Wow. And how much coordination was needed with outside teams, you know, publicists and production crews, network representatives to make something like this happen?
We basically, our creative director, Genevieve Benson, she got the email and we just responded. I believe it was just directly to Don Stevens' show.
Okay.
And so you said it happened fast. How fast did all of this come together? Because obviously it was a well-planned show. There were a lot of great bits highlighting all the different things happening in Monroe County over the span of the, yeah. the years that he's been doing the Late Show. And how much of that was done in-house by you guys?
Well, what happened was he brought his crew with him. We were basically running cameras. We were taking care of behind-the-scenes things. But a lot of it was his people coming in, and we assisted them. It was, again, very quick. I mean, we didn't really have a whole lot. If they did a lot of preparation, a lot of it was done on their side, I'm guessing.
Hmm. And how do you decide the tone to strike when someone like a Stephen Colbert is involved? I mean, do you lean into humor, maybe local storytelling, something more structured?
Oh, we let him and his staff and crew do the heavy lifting on that as well. They definitely had a vision, and they wanted to kind of repeat and enhance what they had done in 2015.
What has been the reaction of people in the county, people in Monroe that have been obviously at the front and center of all of this? What's been their reaction?
We've gotten some great support. We've gotten a huge, wonderful response. It's really brought a spotlight to our station, our local station, and I think to local stations, giving stations like ours a voice again.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and what did this experience kind of teach your team about what's possible for community media moving forward?
It really opens up a lot of doors, I think. It kind of gives us an idea of what really is possible when you take the time and effort, because they came in and really just, you know, opened our eyes as to the way a lot of things happen on network television. It was really fascinating to hear their conversations. So I think it was a learning experience for us, really.
Yeah.
Oh, it absolutely was, yeah.
Yeah, I do want to pick up a little bit on something you said. It draws attention to, you know, local access television and the kind of program that you do. Is there something that you take away from this feeling like, wow, we do this really well? Or, you know, maybe there's another way that we can look at this. And if our resources allow it, we can kind of do some different things.
I think we're looking at it from that perspective. I think we just recently rebranded. We used to be Monroe Public Access for, I don't know how many years, since 92.
Yeah.
And we just rebranded as Monroe Community Media, and we're looking to get more active and do more innovative things as much as we possibly can. And I think this is just the beginning. The timing was impeccable. We couldn't have planned that if we tried.
Our plan now is to really, truly be able to give the people of Monroe County who want to be heard their voice. And that is truly our goal, both in our radio and in our television.
Well, it's very cool. It's a very cool story. I thought it was very funny.
Yes.
I love when Genevieve brought out the ham with the sparkler in it. Turns
Action.
Out, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, her reactions were priceless.
They were great. It was a ham radio.
When she
sale.
Told them not to spit on the floor, that was
yes.
Awesome.
Oh,
yeah, that was hilarious too.
It was very funny, and I'm so happy for you guys that you get to be in the spotlight once again, 11 years later. After
the timing is just the timing was just perfect.
It's very great. It's very cool. Brian Burchett, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, you got it. There's a little bit of. Only in Monroe for you. This is an unbelievable story, too. In 1998, Julia Stewart was the president of Applebee's.
Yeah.
And the then CEO told her that if you're able to turn this company around, if you're able to bring up the sales and revenue, all of those things, yeah. I'll make you CEO.
Okay.
Well, what did Julia Stewart do? She went out and grew sales 14% annually, year over year. The stock doubled. 3 years later, Stewart went back to ask the CEO to make good on his promise, and he said, no, that's not going to happen. Congratulations.
You're done
great
good,
stuff.
But no.
But you can't have my job.
Yeah.
So Stewart quit. She became the CEO at IHOP. IHOP then went through a similar deal. She went and put them back in the black.
Mm-hmm.
And then she offered to acquire Applebee's, which they successfully did in 2017. She called the CEO of Applebee's and said, hey, remember how we had that conversation? You're fired because we don't need two CEOs.
Goodbye. See ya.
I love that story.
See ya.
I love it. But
you
know what?
Know.
You never know if it's tongue-in-cheek. Like, if you do this, I'll give you $1 million,
yeah.
Right? You don't expect anybody to make good on it. But then when she went and improved the company dramatically.
Yes.
Dramatically,
I would have gone back and asked for that too. Like, listen, we did have a conversation. Remember what you said? Look what I've done.
And I love the you know, maybe short memory, but I remember all those years ago when you told me no after you told me you would.
This restaurant is, you know, we got too many people here.
Yeah,
it's not, you know, it's too big.
And now you're fired.
And you're gone.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Monday Munchies back in the mix. Crazy Gringo Mexican Cantina. It's coming up on JR Morning. All right, welcome back. You know, there's just something about Mexican in the morning.
Yeah.
It is darn good. Darn good. And
it goes with everything.
It really does. and the good folks at Crazy Gringo Mexican Cantina, our in-house Tommy and Dimitri Vasilos join us. It's good to see you, fellas.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah, appreciate us.
The aroma is just
oh,
off the
Isn't
charts. Off the charts in here. And you guys are here. We're obviously talking Monday Munchies, highlighting what you guys are doing. But there's also a sweet deal today. It's live right now. For only $25, you get 50. And all you got to do is go to WJR.com. It's there. And the food is absolutely spectacular. So it's going to go a long way.
I appreciate that. We do our best to, you know, came to this country. My parents came to this country in the late 60s, early 70s, started the restaurant business. And we took it on and, you know, decided to go into the Mexican venue there. And it's been a success.
I want to know about the name, Crazy Gringo. How did that name come about?
Well, it's kind of crazy. I was watching an old Elvis Presley movie one time, and the scene was he was in Acapulco doing a show, and he had his girlfriend and he had his wife at the show, and he had them at different ends of the venue, and during intermission, when he would be in the back, the little runner boy.
Mm-hmm.
would he went up to him and he knew that he had his wife at the one end and his girlfriend the other. He looked at Elvis and he said, "You know what? You're one crazy gringo."
Okay,
you're like boom, yeah, light bulb.
That's it.
Yep.
What was it about this particular cuisine that you guys found so intriguing?
Tom?
So we were in the food business forever, 40 years, and we did family dining style. We did catering for the colleges and Baker College. And then I just said, you know what? It's an upcoming thing, Mexican. Who doesn't? Like 30 years ago, it was popular, but then it just started blowing up more and more. So a couple of my friends go, man, I think you should put a Crazy Gringo there at 15 and Gratiot.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while because I had to find the right staff because we never knew the Mexican cuisine. And then I just put all the resources together and slowly took off. And like my chef told me, he goes, listen, it's going to take 2 years to get on the map. And once we're on the map, though, they're gonna know you. So he was right on. And then we ended up entering some contests for our famous barbacoa birria taco. And we just took it to Royal Oak for the big festival.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up winning the People's Award and the Choice Award. And they sent us to Alabama that next winter. And then we competed and we came in third. I think a company from Germany came second. And then I don't know where the first one was, but we came in third. So got to say our taco won third in the world. Wow. So it was pretty good. Yeah.
You guys are all about consistency, too. And what does that mean in your kitchen, especially when you're working with fresh ingredients and house-made sauces that are prepared daily?
Well, the staff is all from Mexico, and we don't even bother them. So
let them do their thing.
We let them do their thing, right? And so we kind of run the front of the house, and they take care of the back of the house. And so, and you know, I see them, and I don't speak Spanish, but I don't get in the middle of them.
Well, the food is absolutely fantastic. I got a steak
that's what I got. Too.
Yes. I mean, absolutely off the charts. Salsas are fantastic. All the guacamole is made fresh daily.
Daily.
I mean, it is the epitome of like fresh Mexican food.
Appreciate that. Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
We do that. And the catering aspect in the summertime, we do grad parties, weddings. We did the air show 2 years ago, and we were going to do it this year, but it got canceled because of the war. But they were looking forward to us. We did all the chalets. So we'll go anywhere. If they want to pay for it, we'll go out of state, wherever. We'll bring the grills and everything.
If someone's never been to the restaurant before, what can they expect when they get there?
Authenticity. It's just every time I hear people come in and they're like, wow, this is the best Mexican we've ever, and it's really from Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They get a nice vibe, I make a Tommy margaritas that I've made on the menu, got on some.
Okay.
And it's all fresh juices and
Tommy margarita?
Tommy margarita.
Uh-oh. So you already know it's
Yeah.
Uh-huh. A little special there.
So that's like the Cadillac of the margaritas there.
Okay.
And if I'm in house and they see my car, I make them. If I'm not there, you know, the girls make them as close as they can get.
Okay.
You want the Tommy made, though.
Yeah, you want me to make the margarita. So if I'm there, you're definitely going to drink more than one.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Well, I'm looking at the menu here. I mean, the prices are incredibly reasonable, and that's important nowadays. Yeah. And so the sweet deal that you have now, it's live, WJR.com. You can go and take advantage of that. $25 gets you $50. Right now, and again, things are expensive now. So that's a wonderful deal you're giving to folks.
Yeah, it is. You know, food costs are through the roof, and you guys, we see it at the grocery stores. We see it everywhere. So,
sure.
We just try our best to make it for the customer and for us. You know, to keep the lights on.
Yeah, and that's why we're doing the sweet deal. And we want people that never tried Crazy Gringo, even though we've been around for 11 years.
Right.
Say, wait a minute, I've never been there. Let me try it. Once they come in, we start with the queso on the guac. Once they start doing that, I tell them not to eat a lot of chips so they can save room because we have some really good desserts,
too. It is the real problem about Mexican restaurants, though.
Uh-huh.
It's always the chips that get you.
The chips that get you. But they sure will.
But the queso's good. The guac's good. Yeah. So, yeah, you get yourself.
And you say you got good desserts as well?
We really got good desserts, yeah.
Okay.
We get the tres leches cake from down here in Mexican town.
Mm-hmm.
We have a cheesecake chimichanga with a homemade blueberry sauce. It's to die for. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, wow.
And then, of course, the churros, the cakes, the fried ice creams and stuff. But
What's the best thing on the menu, do you guys think?
The steak wet burrito is my favorite.
Okay.
Okay.
And mine is the fish tacos.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay.
I love the fish tacos.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all incredibly delicious.
My wife is, I'm sure. I'm getting a text message. I probably have one already. Like, yep, we're going.
We got to go.
It's a wrap.
Yeah, we got to go. Well, thank you guys so much. We appreciate you bringing in the food for us to
taste. Absolutely. Thank you, guys. And love JR. Listen to you guys every day.
Thank you.
Yeah, morning on. Love it.
We appreciate you. Yeah. And again, that sweet deal is live right now. $25 gets you $50. WJR.com, and you'll be able to take advantage of that. Now, Tommy, Dimitri, Vassilos, thank you guys so much.
Yes. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you guys got it. It's awesome. Awesome food. And WJR.com, sweet deals. Get it going. Get yourself a Tommy Margarita.
Get you a Tommy Margarita.
That's right.
I know, that's right.
That's right. It goes well with the tacos.
With anything.
That's exactly right. all right. Well, that's going to do it for us. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to Brad Galley.
Yes.
He's got a new
venture. Mm-hmm.
And so we're excited to talk to him, and we'll keep you updated on all the happenings that you need to be aware of. That's going to do it for us. Kevin Dietz and All Talk coming your way next here on WJR. Have yourself a wonderful Monday, and we'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Have a good one.